All right, looks like we're right on time, so let's go ahead and get started. My name's Chris Hallam. If we could turn down the volume down a little bit, that'd be great, thank you. At any rate, I'm the product manager for all of Windows Client Security, so anything that's in the desktop, IoT, or the mobile OS, that falls into my wheelhouse. I have a peer of mine, Heike Ritter. She focuses on some of the active threat detection pieces, while I focus on identity information protection and what I like to call inactive or kind of more integrity threat resistance types of features. So there's two of us that kind of work in this space. And so today we're going to give you a whirlwind tour of kind of the whole gamut of everything we've done in Windows 10. My goal is to make sure you walk away with the breadth story, but I'm also going to give you some depth along the way. I have put so many slides into this deck, I don't know how I'm going to get it through all of it, to be honest, but I'll talk fast because I really want you to get the full story because there's just so much to talk about. So without further ado, let's just dive right in, and I'll move through some of these slides pretty quickly, like this pitch slide here, because I think you all know this story. You've probably read this a few times. But of course, you know, people are recognizing, especially the boards of organizations are thinking about cyber threats as a material risk to their very existence of their businesses. And it's no surprise, because when you look at what happened to the Bangladesh Bank, if you remember the ATM heists in Russia a number of years ago, where they took tens of millions of dollars in hours out of ATM machines across the country, you know, these types of issues can impact the bottom line. They're devastating. And so when we think about what we need to do in Windows 10 to address this really dangerous, hostile environment that your organizations are connected to on the internet, we need to have a holistic approach. And this is kind of our mental model on how we're going to approach security. We kind of break things into pre-breach defense and post-breach, and then, of course, within those, we have a number of categories. And so we're going to go kind of in a linear way through each one of those categories. I'm going to tell you about all the things we've done within them. Before I get into the details, though, there is one thing that I want you to understand. And so when we built Windows 7, for instance, we built that with security in mind, but the features that we delivered from a security perspective were incremental. Really, what we were thinking about is we were really outsourcing security to third parties. So we gave you a platform that had the security plumbing you needed, but it was really up to third parties to take advantage of that and actually deliver the security that you needed. With Windows 10, we decided that's just not going to work anymore because, of course, the threats and the breaches that you've probably experienced or maybe are experiencing right now, that's something we can't outsource anymore. So we're bringing more of this technology into the box. And because of that, we're able to provide revolutionary security rather than incremental security. And as we go through the presentation, I think that you'll say, wow, that represents a step change in security for my organization. That's not just another set of cool, interesting sounding features. These actually make a real difference, that these are maybe closer to solutions rather than just a long list of defenses that make you a little bit safer. So with that, before we get into the technology, I want to talk about the unsung hero from a security perspective. And so when we think about the attacks that we've experienced since, let's say, Windows XP, in fact, each of these bars you're seeing represent different versions of Windows, right? So we have XP, and then we've got Vista and 7. Let's say the last column there is 8. And so when we released those products, what didn't change in the platform? Well, the security capability of the platform didn't change. We patched vulnerabilities, but we never made the platform any more secure, any more capable than the day we shipped it outside of the patches that we deployed to deal with the vulnerabilities. So in other words, you get a platform that for 2 or 3, actually it's really more like 3 to 5 years, is locked in time. And so what happens then, right? The day we ship a new version of Windows, the attackers start going to town on it, and guess what? They create a gap in protection between the platform you've probably deployed 2, 3 years later. They've got attacks that exceed all the defenses of this great new platform you've just delivered. So this model is broken, right? If new security technology every 3 to 5 years means you're behind. And even with the third party stuff, it just isn't helping. So there's this huge gap. So what's the unsung hero for security? Windows as a service. If you're thinking about deploying LTSB and being locked in time for years and years and years, and you're thinking about deploying that to information workers in particular, you're going to be experiencing the world that you don't want to be in. Now, LTSB has a place in this world. It does not have a place in this world, in my estimation, from a security perspective, on information worker workstations because they connect to the internet, they're doing all sorts of things. If you've got a piece of machinery that has a PC connected to it on the factory floor, it's not connected to the internet, that's a good fit for an LTSB because they're not going to be encountering these dynamic threats because they're locked in a box and they may not have internet connectivity. So think about that. If you're thinking about LTSB, think again. CBB, current branch for business, is the way to go. So let's quickly overview what's changed since Windows 10. And so you're just going to see a bunch of feature names listed here. And we're going to go into the details on the new stuff. But I want you to quickly kind of take in that, wow, this is a huge release from a security perspective. So if you deploy Windows 10 on your existing Windows 7 hardware, and you just run upgrade, you're going to get a lot of great new capability. You're going to have trusted boot. You're going to have Microsoft Edge and this long list of defenses. If you want to take full advantage of Windows 10 security, you need modern hardware. It needs to be running 64-bit, and you need to deploy it with UEFI secure boot mode enabled, okay? There's ways of deploying Windows 10 on a PC where you're in BIOS mode, right? Meaning there's a master boot record and all these boot kit types of problems can continue. So it's important as you deploy that you deploy with secure boot enabled during your deployment, et cetera. And if you do, you're going to get the high-end capability that we have in 10. So just wanted you to take back this and think, okay, we need to be careful about how we deploy. If you just go home and start upgrading PCs, you may be here, right? It's a good place, way better than Windows 7, but you really want to be here. You want to use Device Guard and Credential Guard and all these other great features, because these are the features that defeat these high-end attacks that you're going to be experiencing. So let's drill in a little deeper, and let's talk about device protection. So when it comes to the devices, Windows 8 hardware represented kind of a step change in hardware, right? So if you look at Windows 7, what kind of security hardware do we have in that? Almost none, right? You had TPM. That's a good component, obviously, and we'll talk more about that. But that was really it. But with Windows 8 hardware, we really have changed quite a few things with Intel. We have features like virtualization extensions, right, that we're going to talk about in detail here in a second. We have a bunch of things related to virtualization, actually. We have the ability to do biometrics. We have TPM becoming pervasive on devices. TPM used to be a feature that was only in on the high-end business PCs. Now it's actually even consumer PCs. I don't think you can actually go buy a PC now, unless it's been in the shop for about a year now, that doesn't have a TPM. Even your family, right, has a TPM-enabled device. And that's because it's critical. Biometric sensors are now becoming pervasive, et cetera. But it's really the virtualization capability that I want to spend some time on, because this is where the step change in security happens, right? Using virtualization and hardware isolation allows us to get into a completely different security posture, as you'll see. And the threat that we really need to think about is when you have an operating system, whether it's Linux or OS X or Windows, and you put all of these things on the perimeter, right? All those defenses, even the very best in the industry, are all susceptible to vulnerabilities that will allow the user to maybe get admin privilege or maybe standard user privilege or maybe even kernel level privilege. And if you get access to the kernel and you elevate to that security level, then there's no defense running on top of Windows that can keep you safe. And when you have people from the NSA making statements like this, that their goal is to have a USB stick full of 0 days, and as you see at the bottom this little text here, you see that you can now buy these on the cheap for $95,000. Remember a few years ago people were talking about $1 million 0 days and $500,000 0 days? These things are cheap. They're all over the place. For $95,000, anybody who wants to break an organization would have that money available to them. So 0 days and vulnerabilities are increasingly a threat that we've always known about, but now it's becoming even easier. So we have to change the approach. We need to create the condition where these vulnerabilities don't matter anymore. Now, I say that in jest. They're always gonna matter, right? But what we wanna do is we wanna create the condition where it doesn't mean you're gonna get owned, right? Wouldn't it be nice to know that if you had an unpatched vulnerability that at least some things in your world were still safe? That's the type of technology we're working on we'll talk about here in the next slide. But before we get there, I want you to understand very clearly what is the vulnerability threat we face. Well, first of all, there's cheap zero-day exploits out there that are going to be unleashed on you. But let's talk about what those vulnerabilities actually lead the attacker into gaining. Well, the way the platform works, whether it's any desktop operating system, and even mobile OSs are like this as well, is they have this stack, right? You got a kernel, you got platform services with an app platform, and then you have the app running on top of it. In the desktop world, those apps run with your privilege. Right? So if we're running Word, as an example, under your privilege, well, if Word was a malicious app, it would have access to all the files in the file system, all the settings that you as a standard user have access to, et cetera. If it's a different type of app, let's imagine it's an app that's running as admin, then the attacker, if there was a vulnerability, would gain admin privilege, and then they can start turning off all of your defenses, right? If the vulnerability app gives them admin access, they can also poke down a little bit lower in the stack, and maybe they can elevate to system, which is greater than admin, or if they have a kernel mode exploit, then they can own the kernel and turn off all of your defenses, while at the same time making them look healthy, so all your SecOps tools are saying, hey, everything's cool on this endpoint, when in fact, actually, it's completely owned and under the control of someone else. So the problem we face, just to be super clear, is the apps are running with way too much privilege. This privilege allows an attacker who exploits a vulnerability to be you or greater, maybe an admin or maybe even running in kernel privilege. So how do we address this threat? Well, you could put a sandbox in there, right? So mobile phones have sandboxes, and those are very effective. So that would be putting a layer between the app layer and that Windows Platform Services. And we have that in Windows 8. Modern apps or universal apps have a sandbox. But what's the problem with software sandbox? Guess what? If there's a vulnerability, then you're going to escape from it. So it's a good step. It's a great step, actually. It provides a lot of value, but we need it to be even safer. And so how are we doing that in Windows 10? Well, this is where the step change happens. We're using virtualization-based security, type of technology we've had in the server world for quite a while, and we are isolating, over time, more and more components out of Windows, which is the left-hand side, and we're moving it in to a separate hardware-isolated container. Anything that's running in that container should be safe, even from the Windows, even if the kernel's compromised. So vulnerabilities still matter. It stinks, you know, when that happens because the attacker has your data, but at least the things running in this box on the right-hand side, those are going to be safe and secure against a compromised OS. So what are the types of things we push over there? Well, we're going to do authentication over there. We're going to do malware-resistance types of things in there, and we're going to do more and more, and we'll talk about those in the slides and the scenarios later in the deck. But this technology, new architecture for Windows. This is the source of all the great promises that you're going to hear about throughout the rest of the presentation. So it's a little geeky, but this is the hero feature, virtualization-based security, hardware isolation. So let's go a little further, and let's talk about threat resistance using that new architecture, and we're even going to talk about how we go a little further. So the types of things that you're worried about are all these things. You're worried about people tampering with your device, right? And so with modern hardware that has UEFI Secure Boot, which is a BIOS replacement, we can actually do a pretty good job at preventing that from happening. In the old world, an attacker would gain admin privilege and they would install a boot kit running under Windows. Maybe they would tamper with the firmware components in your option ROMs, maybe on the video card or elsewhere on the PC, and the next time you boot your PC, your Windows is under the control of these things running under it, right? They're running inside hardware, they're running under the Windows bootloader, and so we, with UEFI Secure Boot, have a promise that almost can be made, which is that we can prevent bootkits from getting in firmware, we can prevent anything from starting before Windows, and why I say it's a promise that can almost be made is nothing's unbreakable, right? And I can't promise absolute security because that would be a crazy thing to do. But what we can say is the attack vectors that we're used to that resulted in these Trojans running under Windows or inside hardware, the surface area of attack that remains is minuscule compared to where it was before. So we can't promise unbreakable, but I don't know of a boot kit running under Windows with UEFI config at this point. So I'm sure there will be a day when it happens, but this is much better than where you're at with Windows 7. So let's talk about kind of how we think about threat resistance. The way I'm kind of modeling it now is kind of how the slide's trying to articulate. And what we ideally want to do is we want to create the condition where your PC never even encounters a threat. So you're on the web. Wouldn't it be great if we could prevent you from ever going to malicious websites? Wouldn't it be great if malicious code couldn't end up in your inbox or malicious links or applications? And so technologies like Smart Screen and ATP and the Windows Firewall are designed to make it so the PC doesn't actually encounter a threat in the first place. But of course, it turns out that those only defend you about roughly about 97% of the threats that we see on the internet. Those defenses block those. So these are kind of another unsung hero, right? Most of the heavy lifting on threat resistance happens with things like Smart Screen, right? We just keep you away from malicious things. But that 3% is a huge volume. It's astronomically large. And so we need defenses that you see here on the bottom to deal with those. And so we'll talk about all of these in a little more detail. So I think the Smart Screen and Office ATP, which helps keep malicious things out of your inbox, I think those technologies are pretty clear. So I'm not going to go into any more detail. But let's talk about the things within. What is the number one way for malware to get on your endpoint? Well, a lot of people will raise their hand, they'll say, yeah, it's your inbox, right? That's where all the malicious links are happening. That's true. But what do those links lead to? Well, they lead to your browser. So yes, your inbox or malicious search results that end up, those are the way they lure you to a threat, but at the end of the day, the exploit happens inside a browser. It could be Microsoft Edge, it could be any browser, right? Those are the number one entry point into the system. And I think most of you would tend to agree with that. There are other vectors of attack, there's malicious USBs, et cetera, but the web is the easiest way to lure people to threats. And so what we want to do with Edge is we want to provide the most secure browser in the world. And we've been working very hard on that for a long time, and as you'll see, I think we can actually assert, and by the way, I had to go through all sorts of gymnastics with our legal team to get the ability to say this, is we are confident that in this moment we have the world's, or we're about to have when we release this new technology, I'm going to talk about it in a minute, it will be the world's most secure browser. And that's a big claim. We do not make claims like that on Microsoft. Legal always says no, but we sat down, we went through the architecture that I'm going to show you here in a minute, and they're like, wow. That's different than anybody's doing in the industry. So we'll talk about what that is in a minute. But before we get there, let's talk about how secure it is right now in the version of Windows 10 that you can go install today. Well, a lot of people measure security in terms of the number of vulnerabilities that are in the browser. That's actually not a great way of thinking about things. There's all sorts of other variables, but if you want to think about this one, look how good we're doing compared to the competition. We're doing really good. We're shipping 50% fewer vulnerabilities than everyone else. So we're pretty proud of the engineering effort that it takes to write that type of code quality, and that's yielding some great results because there's just fewer opportunities for people to exploit the browser. And that's all based on the version that we, before the one we just shipped. So we just released Redstone 1, the anniversary update as we call it. And what this is a new feature we just shipped that's going to make an even bigger impact. So one of the problems we face in Microsoft Edge, and this is at the same problem that's shared in Chrome and others, is the way they host other processes within it. So for instance, Flash is hosted inside Chrome, and it's also inside of IE. So that's something we'll talk about in a minute. But one of the challenges kind of behind that, behind the scenes, that doesn't get talked about, but I know security people like you will be interested in this, is there's this library behind it. And so when you're using Flash or when you're using Edge and Flash, they're going to be talking to this thing called win32k.sys. And this is this library in Windows that's been around forever. And it's, to be honest, between us in the room here, it's kind of fragile. It's been around for a long time. And there's a lot of very nuanced behavior in that runtime that everything on top of the UI is using that kind of depends that we don't make big changes in there. And there's some things in there that attackers can find ways to exploit that are really hard for us to change. And so what we need to do is we need to keep attackers away from this library, right? Let's shield them away from it. The way things were prior to the anniversary update, attacker, if they found a vulnerability in the browser or in Flash, they got direct access to this runtime, and then they could go to town on it and they could breach the system. So what we've done is we did some research, like, okay, how can we shield it? Well, it turned out after our research, we found out that this huge library, win32k.sys, of all the interfaces it had, it turned out the browser only needed access to about 40% of it. Yet we gave them access to the full 100%. So what we've done in the anniversary update is we've added basically a filter. Any call coming from Edge is going to be hooked and before it's allowed to touch this library, and if Edge doesn't need access to that particular function, it gets blocked, as you can kind of see here at the bottom. So we are filtering everything coming through Edge, and they no longer have access to the full functionality of this library. So that means, you know, 60% surface area reduction, right? In security, it's all about reducing surface area of attack. Doing it by 60% in a single blow is a huge improvement, and we know this is going to make the browser even more secure than it already is. We've done the same thing to Flash. Flash didn't need all that access either. We do two things with Flash. One, we filter its access to this library, and then we've also moved it outside of Edge. It's no longer running in proc. It runs out of proc, and it runs in its own sandbox. So if there's a Flash vulnerability that's detected, it's a bad day, but we got a sandbox behind it. Now they need to find a vulnerability in the sandbox, and that's, again, another reduced area of surface attack. It's not a very big piece of code that's sitting there, and so we know that that's going to prove very effective for, you know, for Flash vulns, which, to be honest, that's one of the number one gateways into exploiting the browser is actually through Flash. So the combination of these things are going to be hugely impactful. I can't wait to talk to you next year about, okay, what did we see impact-wise? How does that change the dynamics of what we're seeing vulnerability-wise? But I know that it's going to be good because we know that that win32k.sys was highly targeted. So let's talk about where we go from here. So we've got half the bones that the others have. We've got this great new feature we just talked about that's going to make it even harder for attackers to go after Edge. But where do we go? Well, let me show you a quick video, maybe before I showed it. Who went to the keynote here? Just so I kind of get a sense of people. Okay, so about half of you went to the keynote. So the people who went are going to see about 90 seconds of stuff that they've seen before. But for the other half, they'll see it for the first time. So let's go ahead and present the video here.
The internet has completely changed the way we work and do business. It's hard to imagine a world without it. Today, attacks frequently target the browser, any browser, as a way to breach organizations and access their data, so it's critical that we make it a safe place. With Windows Defender Application Guard, we want to make your experiences just that, safe and secure. We're excited to show you this in Microsoft Edge. Websites that are considered untrustworthy by your business or enterprise will automatically launch Microsoft Edge in an isolated session. These sessions are visually different to ensure users understand they're in a more secure browsing environment. Enterprise administrators have full control to decide which sites the organization trusts and which launch protected with Application Guard. Our patented hardware virtualization technology extends beyond the kernel level, protecting your network from malware, viruses, vulnerabilities, and even zero-day attacks, the things we can't plan for. This lightweight virtual machine isolates malicious activity coming from the web, preventing it from reaching the underlying operating system, apps, and data. If the user encounters malicious content, it's contained within Application Guard. The user can close this session without impacting their PC or network. So as your employees browse the web, Application Guard and Microsoft Edge keep your business network safe and secure.
Audio Jungle.
All right, perfect. So Windows Defender Application Guard is a new platform technology that uses hardware-based isolation, similar to what we showed in those early slides. That new architecture has been extended not just to protect Windows services. The system container is only designed to protect Windows. The Windows Defender Application Guard creates an environment to start protecting apps. Now, this platform feature is a journey, and it takes a lot of work to make it robust enough to run any possible application within it. There's all sorts of things that each app needs that are unique, so making it generic is very difficult. So where we've gone on the roadmap for this feature is we've gone just far enough to start supporting the functionality of a browser like Microsoft Edge. So Windows Defender Application Guard has a roadmap to be much broader, but for today, and when I say today, this is a feature that will be previewed this year in our Windows Insider preview program, and then next year in H1 we're going to ship it for production so you can run it in your environment. But I think the video did a pretty good job kind of talking through it. But just to be super clear, one of the great value propositions of this is this does something that everybody says they do, but this one does it right. Everybody says that they've got great malware defense, they've got great vulnerability defenses, and they even deal with zero days. Everybody says that in all their marketing materials. This is the one feature that I'm aware of, and there's another company that does something similar, so we'll talk more about them in a minute, where that promise is actually kept. And the reason why is because of this. This is the architecture that you probably could see in your head when I kind of alluded to the fact that it was connected to our virtualization-based security work. The thing that happens in the browser is this browser is fully isolated from the host. And so what does that mean? That means it's not running on Windows anymore. It's in a completely separate parallel environment. That environment has no access to Windows. It doesn't have access to your data. It doesn't have access to your apps, your network. It doesn't have access to anything except the web and the pages that you're rendering and trying to view. So it's fully isolated. So if you have a vulnerability in Edge in this environment, and then a vulnerability even maybe in the sandbox that is living within the software sandbox, and you have a vulnerability even at the kernel, which is the bottom of the stack, you still own nothing other than the browser session. So it's a disaster for your browser session, especially if you're on your banking website. The attacker, in theory, might be able to see what you're typing if they installed like a keylogger or whatever, or start screen scraping. But everything there in the middle, everything on the right-hand side, it's going to be fine. Nobody can really make that promise except for another company named Bromium. And there may be some others. I can't speak that I know everybody in the industry, but the Bromium is the only other company I know of that is using virtualization-based security and micro-virtualization, as they call it, to isolate things away from the desktop itself. So this is hugely impactful. Bromium is a product that is kind of like where our roadmap is. Our roadmap is maybe 5 years, 6, 7 years out to kind of make it a generic platform where any app could run it. And maybe we'll never go there. But right now, we're focusing on Edge, and we'll probably add some other apps. So Bromium and our solution here can be run together. In fact, we think that's a great idea, right? Use our isolation technology that's built in the box to protect Edge, and if you want to use other browsers and get this similar type of protection in Chrome or Firefox, go talk to Bromium. They can protect those. They also protect some other apps. So there's truly a better together relationship. In fact, we have a partnership with Bromium, and so we are working together on these technologies. And while we'll go more, in the future, we'll do a broader base of apps. I think for the foreseeable future, you're going to be probably using both, provided you have the budget to purchase Bromium. When you close this environment, so let's imagine you're at a web page and you close the browser, anything that has happened inside that environment is completely wiped away. So let's imagine you were lured to a website, you clicked on a link, and behind the scenes, the malware just got installed inside that environment. When you close the browser, it's all gone. Everything goes back to normal. And nothing, of course, on the middle or the right-hand side will be impacted. So let me show you just a slower version of the demo. So let's see here. So this is basically taken right from the video itself, so you've seen this, but I'll go through it a little slower. So in this case here, what the demo was trying to articulate is when the user clicks on this link, the browser, which is going to open, has a 0 day in Edge, or excuse me, this is a Windows 7 example, so it's going to be an Internet Explorer. There's a vulnerability in the sandbox it has, which we called Enhanced Protected Mode. And there's a kernel-level exploit, and that allowed the attacker to do what you'll see happens, which is they're able to turn off the firewall and the anti-malware solution. Now, this could be any third-party AV or firewall, right? So it's not just something that can happen to us. An attacker also wouldn't do exactly this. They would probably hide their tracks. If they have access to the kernel, they can create the condition where these solutions will still appear to be running to all of your monitoring products, and the user will not be aware that these features have been turned off. So in other words, everything will continue to look green even though the system has been completely owned. So that's what can happen on Windows 7, but of course when you have Windows Defender Application Guard running IE within it, you'll see in the upper left-hand corner, we want to make sure the user recognizes that, hey, we're in a more secure mode. I've moved from the secure web, which might be my intranet websites, and I'm now on the web, and then the browser then spins up in this new mode, running in isolated mode. So to be clear, when you run Microsoft Edge, and you're going to your local websites on your intranet, or you go to trusted sites on the web, maybe business partners, et cetera, you're gonna run in normal mode. It's only when you get into the Wild West, right, some unknown website that you don't trust, that we then switch, kind of put the shields up, and put you into this new environment. And so why don't we just run this in protected mode all the time? Well, there's gonna be some trade-offs you're gonna make. Because malware can't come through and end up on your host, guess what else can't come through and end up on your host? Anything, right? So if you wanna go to a website and download a document or save a web page onto the host, can't do it anymore. So there are some trade-offs here. Now, we do have some things that we've done to make it more usable. So it's not all bad, by the way. Is you can, for instance, use print. So you could print to PDF and then save that local. Why can't I just save a PDF? Why do you make me print it? Well, it turns out we've got a great filter in the print to PDF thing that would strip out any malicious things from it. And so we can save what we know will be a healthy PDF so that you don't end up with an exploit in Adobe Reader when it opens up a PDF local. You can print to printers, you can print to PDF, you can also print to XPS. So a lot of your browsing will still work just the way you want because you're only going to put the untrusted web on this. So my guess is some organizations will say, hey, anything that's running on our corporate network, I'll put that in the trust list. And any business partners where we need to go share information, I go up to their website, I'm going to trust that website as well. But if it's not on that safe list, then it goes into isolated mode. Some people will feel the friction even there is too great. And so some customers will say, you know what, I'm going to put the top 200 websites and allow my users to go to those in non-isolated mode. I know I'm incurring potentially a lot of risk in doing that, but I'm surely better than where I'm at today in today's world, right? So you'll amp this up to meet your requirements. DoD's just locking it down. You can't go to the web and untrusted sites. For you, maybe you choose to put Facebook in there. And of course, with social engineering on Facebook, that could end up to bad results, so I'm not suggesting you do that. But you can decide how secure you want this to be and how flexible you want to be for your users. One other thing that doesn't work at this point is persistence of cookies and credentials. So when you're in isolated mode, we don't persist those things. Now, we will release this in H1 next year with some of these limitations. And in H2, guess what? We're going to start removing some of these limitations. So we want to get this technology out to customers as soon as possible. DoD is going to deploy this very, very quickly because, of course, they can't tolerate any risk. Some customers will choose to use it as well. We think in H2, that's when we probably get rid of some of these persistent issues. We can bring more content through in a safe way, and then maybe it becomes more usable for a broader range of enterprises. So this is a super powerful feature, but we recognize, based on our we polled some of our customers, about 30% of our enterprise customers said, with these limitations, we're going to use it. So I'm just being super transparent with you. This is an amazing feature. I think in H2, we can go from 30 to 70 or even 80. By fixing those little burrs that are in the first release. All right. So the browser, and by the way, just to refer back what LegalNow says, with that technology, Edge is the most secure browser. And I've never made a statement like that as a security guy. I've been at Microsoft for 20 years. I've never said that. But we know that this paves the way. Now, as soon as other browsers start doing virtualization, which will take some years for them to probably build that type of technology, then maybe they can make that claim and we'll have to say we're designed to be the most secure browser or something funny like that. But at any rate, let's talk about a different pathway of attack. So your browsing going to be much more secure, obviously, but there are other pathways for malware to hit your endpoint. And so they can come through USB and all the different ways that you can imagine. And so what we recognize at Microsoft is antivirus is useful as it is. It's a losing fight against the attackers, right? There's no way that we can create enough signatures to deal with the latest malware threats that are arriving on the internet every second. We've seen websites that create custom malware packages for every single user that arrives on the website, which means that I need a new signature, some new behavior monitoring to address these polymorphic types of malware. So there's no way to keep up. There will always be patient zeros and hundreds and maybe thousands, depending how fast and viral a particular malware instance can be. So our solution cannot be better, faster AV, it has to be app control. App control has to be your number one feature to try to deploy in your environment. If you lock down your devices so they only run trusted applications, then the latest variant of CryptoLocker, which comes out every 5 minutes or whatever, it blocks that one too. It blocks all variants of CryptoLocker because the only thing that can run on your PC is something that you've said, I trust this publisher. And so what is a publisher? Well, a publisher, of course, is somebody like Microsoft. And when I say who a publisher is, we're talking about cryptographic signing of the applications themselves. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think I've kind of explained this slide in enough detail. So there's no way that we can live in a trust everything model and use signature-based detection. We need to move into a trust nothing model where every single application has to prove that it's trustworthy because it's signed and it has integrity still, and that signer is listed in a list of safe signers, right? And so our feature for this was AppLocker in Windows 7. And AppLocker is hugely impactful. The customers who deploy this, they tell me, like, man, we aren't really dealing with malware anymore, right? There's some bypasses for AppLocker and Bit9 and other things like it, and we tried to solve that problem, which I'll describe in more detail here in a minute, with DeviceGuard. And DeviceGuard represents the next generation of AppLocker. It's the new version of it, you might call it, that's coming up. And we believe this has a security superiority versus anything in the marketplace, as I'll describe here in a minute. So what is DeviceGuard? DeviceGuard, like I said, it's basically AppLocker. It's the ability to say, these are the apps that I trust, and nothing else can run on the endpoint. Okay, so it's that. It's based on signatures. Those signatures could be based on the literally the file is signed. Or it could be a list of hash values. So if you're familiar with a binary, you can run it through an algorithm and we can get this hash value that represents that specific unique instance. So we can take those hash values for binaries that are not signed and we can put those in a list and you can then trust those. So in other words, you don't have to have everything in your environment signed. That's the ideal. You should make sure that everything in your environment is signed. But in the event there are unsigned binaries, you can also put hashes into this list, which makes it work in any environment. So that makes it flexible. But what makes it differentiated versus, let's say, Bit9 as an example, are two things. The first thing is the policy itself that comes down for DeviceGuard is signed as well. Today, your group policy settings come down to an endpoint, And if an attacker is compromised that PC and has admin control, they can change all your group policy settings, right? If you're an admin, you can change all these settings, right? So there's rogue admin concerns, and then there's rogue malware concerns, right? They can change policy settings. Well, guess what? With Device Guard, one thing that makes it next generation is because the policy is signed, and because when this policy is consumed by Windows, the only thing that can change that policy is a new policy that is signed by the same signer. That means that your admins or malware that has admin privilege or even system privilege cannot tamper with your policy. So nobody else in the marketplace that we're aware of has that kind of admin tamper-proofing to that level, right? They may have some things that get in the way, but I don't know of anybody else who has a promise that, hey, if an attacker is an admin, has admin control, I don't know of anybody who can say that they can still protect the integrity of the policy. So I mentioned that admins, it's basically admin tamper-proof. If you have system privilege, which is greater than admin, it works against that. But what about the kernel? The attacker compromises the kernel. Guess what? All bets are off, even for my cool new signed policy. So we have a defense there. So Device Guard has a really cool feature called hypervisor code integrity. I'm sorry, the name is kind of geeky. But what hypervisor code integrity does is it makes sure that everything running in kernel mode has been compiled and designed with security best practices. So the ability for a vulnerability to exist in that code is kind of the same, right? You can still write buggy code, but the ability for an attacker to compromise that code because of this service has all these defenses behind it is very, very low. So kernel mode exploits on a PC running Device Guard going to be very, very low compared to what we experience today because this service is hardening kernel mode. So I'm sure an exploit will happen one day, but again, this is one of those things where we can reduce the surface area of attack by magnitude's order, and so that's how we defend against the kernel mode attacker. So Device Guard is something you should put on your list. Department of Defense in Australia, the United States, put app control as their number one. When they stack rank the defenses, they put that right up there on the top. Now, one thing you're probably thinking of is, well, okay, the promise is great, but it's still hard to deploy. I need to come up with this list of safe apps, and that's hard, and we totally agree. That's something that we're going to take a few versions of Windows to make super easy, but with the anniversary update, we just made a big improvement that's going to make it a lot easier for you. So when you image your PC, it's very easy to generate a list of safe things that are part of that image, right? So that's part of the process is easy. But what about when users start getting new applications for your management system? What we've done in the anniversary update and SCCM is we've added a hook. So when SCCM pushes binaries down to the endpoint, they automatically get added to the safe list. So if you're in an environment that images your PCs and then pushes all your content through a management system, Device Guard's really easy. If you let your users go to the Wild West on the web and start downloading random apps at will, then Device Guard can prove to be a lot more challenging. But we're working on something to even deal with that. And hopefully next time we meet next year, we can tell you more about what that's going to look like. But you can foresee a curated, published list from Microsoft futuristically that will inform Device Guard, so you don't have to do list management yourselves. But that's something that you'll probably see next year. So that's Device Guard. And again, what makes Device Guard so good? Why is it so tamper-proof? It's because its components are running in this virtualized-based security environment. So even if somebody compromises the kernel on the OS, it can be very hard for them to tamper with anything going on. So another investment there. But let's talk about Windows Defender. You know, app control is not going to be for everyone. We recognize that some organizations will do it and others won't because the manager of the list can be challenging. So Windows Defender is an important part of the story. A lot of customers ask me, well, if I'm going to do Device Guard, do I need antivirus anymore? Obviously, when you have app control, signature-based detection is not going to, I would say it's not needed anymore, but it's not going to be doing the blocking, right? Because Device Guard is going to do it. But Windows Defender would still play a role here, and here's what it is. Let's imagine that a binary came down to your endpoint. Device Guard says, hey, I'm not going to allow that to run, but it's still physically present on your PC, right? So it's basically kind of quarantined, and it can't do anything. Windows Defender is going to, when we get a signature for that particular binary, we'll wipe that off the endpoint. So there's no impact because Device Guard defended you, but Windows Defender antivirus will then remove the binaries that will effectively have done nothing on the endpoint other than being physically present on the file system. So Defender and Device Guard do work hand in hand. But for organizations who can't move into the app control world, something we've been working very hard on since Windows 8 is to improve Windows Defender as a solution. With Windows 8, we released a solution that the industry called baseline protection, and that was done, at least with that release, by design. Our goal was to basically defend people who wouldn't pay for antivirus. It turned out the quality of the protection was actually really good, but we weren't trying specifically to make it a number one or a number two, a number three, or even a number 10 product in the list if you were to stack rank them based on quality. To be clear, it actually was pretty good, but it wasn't as good as others, especially when you look at how they score things. So if you look at 2014, you'll see that we were getting 0 stars out of, I guess, 6 from AV test. And right when we shipped Windows 8, and it was actually a little bit before, we said, we need to reduce the total cost of ownership of Windows. How are we going to do that? We said, hey, you know what? People are spending way too much money on antivirus. Not only that, they're getting bad experiences. A lot of the third-party AV kills performance on your PC, right? In a significant way, like over 10%, over 20%, sometimes up to 40% depending on the AV vendor. So performance is a huge, huge problem. Windows Defender is probably one of the most performant versions out there, which is great. So we had that, we've always had that, but we needed to amp up the protection. And so we decided, hey, in the interest of lowering total cost of ownership, in the interest of having our users be happier with Windows, because when AV is consuming all the resources, people tend to not blame McAfee. They say that they don't like Windows, right? They blame us. And so we decided we've got to fix this problem. And so we made the investments in people, in machine learning, researchers, et cetera. And the fruits of our efforts started to pay off in 2015. Our goal is to become number one. We're not there yet, but we're pretty darn close. As you see, I think at the bottom of the slide, okay, top of the slide there, we scored a 98.1 in March 2016. We'll take a look and see what I think there's some new numbers coming out here really soon, so we'll see what those numbers are. But you can see the dramatic improvement, and it's because for the first time we were trying to become a number one, right? It was never about competence in 2013, it was about what our goals were. Our goals are very different. So the takeaway I want you to leave with is, if you're using third-party antivirus because you thought Defender wasn't good enough for you, I think again, when you deploy Windows 10, this is a great way to save $25 a seat or less or more, depending on how much your organization is paying for your antivirus package. And we're going to keep on chugging away at this until we become number one. Okay, so let's move to another area. We're switching gears completely. We've talked a lot about threats. Let's talk about identity. So with Windows 10, identity was one of the number one things we wanted to do, right? We wanted to make a huge impact on malware and vulnerabilities and hacking. We also wanted to solve the identity problem. And when it comes to user identities, we have a huge, huge problem, right? In fact, just last week, we learned how bad the Yahoo thing that we all had heard about in the past, 500 million user accounts stolen. I mean, that is unbelievable number, and I'm not taking a pot shot at Yahoo because we've all been hacked in ways that have revealed data. But the point we're trying to make here is that identity is definitely a hot commodity. What's interesting is we still to this day see evidence of this hack happened a number of years ago. We see these accounts being used even today for the first time. So some of these users, of course, weren't aware that their account were hacked, and so they've continued to use their passwords. These accounts are still being sold in the black market, and now users' accounts are getting owned for the first time, even in 2016, you know, years after the initial breach. So we're going to continue to see this because of this one, and there are many, many others like it, eBay, on and on. Everybody's had this this problem. Not everybody, of course, but many have. So what is the problem with these credentials? Well, it's because passwords are terrible. We all know why passwords are horrible. But just as a refresher, it's a single factor of authentication, and it's what we call a symmetrical secret. And so what's a symmetrical secret? It means that there's symmetry between the secret that you have, which is the string of text, and what the identity provider on the other end has as well. So they know my secret and I know my secret, right? So what does that mean? It means eBay knows my password. It means Amazon knows my password, et cetera. So if I breach Amazon, then I can steal this user's password. So that all changes when you move to asymmetrical secrets. Asymmetrical secrets are based on keys, private key, public key pairs, and we often use PKI solutions to make that all go. And so we use smart cards and these types of things with a certificate. The problem with PKI is, as wonderful it is, it's also a single point of failure. If somebody breaches your organization and they use pass the hash as a way to move into the data center and maybe compromise your CA, then all your user identities are compromised, right? So the CA is wonderful until it gets compromised when you have, that's your Armageddon day. The other challenge is PKI is just hard to deploy and manage, right? Who here uses smart cards in their organization? Right? Very, very few. I mean, smart cards are kind of like the state of the art. Right? That's like what everybody wants, at least in terms of security. But the form factor is horrible. You need a card reader. You need a physical card. So nobody deploys it. And even an organization like Microsoft, which is very motivated to be highly secure, we only required smart card use for VPN access. So every day for the last 20 years at Microsoft, although I don't think we had smart cards 20 years ago when I started, but we would use passwords to log in because the friction was too hard with a smart card. So we want to solve this problem, and we have. We're taking the best parts of smart card technology, which is the asymmetrical secret thing, and the ability to protect those that public-private key pair, and Windows Hello is based on that smart card-like technology. But Windows Hello for businesses is really like a virtual smart card. You don't need a card reader and a card. We're actually going to turn your PC into a smart card reader and a card, and that's an analogy, right? It's not really a smart card, obviously. But fundamentally, from a security standpoint, it's exactly the same thing. So we have asymmetrical secrets, and like a smart card, which uses a chip to protect those secrets, we use the Trusted Platform module that's in every one of your PCs to protect that secret. So if somebody gets kernel mode access and wants to get your private key, they're not going to get it, right? It's protected by the TPM, which is a piece of hardware, and there's really no way to effectively get it. So that's great. These keys can come from your public key infrastructure. So if you are savvy with PKI, you can use certificates as your means. But as an alternative, we can have Windows generate the public-private key pair, and we can send that public key up to your Active Directory service. That's actually more secure, because when you're not using a certificate that came through your CA, right, which gives you a single point of failure, in this case here, the only place in the world where my private key or data about it exists is on the endpoint. Microsoft, just to be fully transparent, found the easiest path to go to Windows Glo, because we had PKI expertise and we had it all deployed. We chose to use certificates. So it was just easy to make it happen. We were able to quickly deploy Windows Hello. And in fact, we're running Windows Hello on almost 100,000 users at Microsoft. Are no longer using passwords for auth. They're using Windows Hello. And so that's a big deal. And if we can do it, you can do it as well. Over time, we will switch to this key-based mode and start not using certificates for identity. And I'm not sure what the roadmap is on that, but that's something that we're going to get to, because that'll add another layer of increased security for us. So Windows Hello is two things. It's the keys that we just talked about. It's your identity. But then there's also factors of authentication. In the original release, we really thought about Windows Hello as a biometrics thing. So we supported facial, iris, and fingerprints. We also supported pins. But we really generally didn't talk about that under the banner of Hello. But technically, even a pin was part of the Hello piece. And just to be super clear about pin, pin's just a string of text. And I often get people asking me, well, why is that any better than a password? Why is it better? It's because it's one of the two factors. You need to steal the user's PIN, and you also have to steal their device to compromise their identity. So somebody can lure you to a website and phish your PIN, but then they need to go find you and your device to actually use their identity. So that's why PINs, even though they're strings of text, are more secure, because they're always one of two factors. With the anniversary update, we've added a new type of thing. So as far as factors go, we support PINs. We support three biometric modalities. With Windows Anniversary Update, we've released another factor type. That factor type can be an external device. We have a new technology called the Windows Hello Companion Device Framework. The Companion Device Framework allows devices to be used as an external factor. So for instance, my smart card today has a chip. Well, the company who builds my smart card is HID, a company that many of you know. They will be shipping a NFC-based device, and I'll be able to tap to sign in to a PC with that. So some organizations are like that. I don't think Microsoft would use that particular solution, but I think maybe a retailer would. Imagine being able to walk to a cash register and tap to unlock that. Imagine being on the factory floor at Boeing and you're building an airplane, you need access to a specific piece of machinery. Imagine being able to use your badge and you just badge to sign in to get access to a device that you've been trained on. So external devices are helpful for those scenarios. They can also be helpful for people who are who work for government and public sector here in the United States. They have to adhere to FIPS 140-2. How many people are government, work for government type of people? So a lot of you. So FIPS 140-2 requires physical separation between the device and the credential store, and that's why you use CAC cards if you're a government person, which is basically a smart card. The Companion Device Framework allows, again, you know, an external device like a CAC card to be used with Windows Hello. So this new Companion Device Framework allows Windows Hello to be used in any possible scenario. We don't know of any scenarios where it can't work. From a technical standpoint, the IHV community is building all sorts of interesting devices. Some of those IHVs are here. YubiKey, is one example. NEMI has a really interesting wristband that actually takes a look at my electrocardiogram. This is my band. I don't have the NEMI band, but this is my band too for Microsoft. But it's a band like this. It actually looks at my ECG electrocardiogram. As long as the wearer matches the person who enrolled the NEMI band, then I would be able to remotely unlock my PC just by pressing a button. There's other devices like that where just physical presence near your PC through Bluetooth would unlock a PC. And that's got some security implications. I don't know if I would do that for commercial, but maybe home users might like that. You know, just wearing, imagine just wearing your Microsoft band. You walk up to your PC, it's already unlocked. You can do that. And so something we just added in the anniversary update, based on what we knew we needed to do, but also based on customer feedback, is they're very worried about the biometric credentials getting lost, right? Your fingerprint is a non-revocable credential, because you're never going to get a new fingerprint, right? You don't want to have to move to your other fingers if somebody stole that biometric data. So we take that data, we encode it. Even if you were to get it off Windows, it would be very, very difficult to actually make use of it. You can never actually reverse it back to a print. It's basically, we put it through an algorithm, it becomes a bunch of binary data. You can never reverse it back to an image. But people are still very worried about it. So we've moved that into our isolation environment. So now you can't even get the data. On the existing release, you can get the data, but you really can't use it. Now it's even more secure and hardened with this recent release. So what makes Windows Hello great? If it was just a proprietary solution for Microsoft networks and Microsoft services, that would be great. But it wouldn't be good enough, because you live in a real world, which is a world of heterogeneous devices, Android and iOS, et cetera. Windows Hello is based on the work of the FIDO Alliance, and this is an area of interesting collaboration between Microsoft and Google. Windows Hello is FIDO 2.0 compliant. That's a specification, a standard. It's an international standard. It's one that Microsoft and Google jointly created. So Windows Hello is based on a standard. Google, we expect, will be shipping their equivalent of Windows Hello based on the 2.0 standard probably next year sometime. Maybe it'll happen sooner. I'm not sure what their schedule is, but they're going to be delivering that. So this solution we just talked about works in the heterogeneous world. It's going to be able to manage the same way. This is kind of one of those great moments where the industry all came together to fix a problem that we could have never fixed in isolation. So that's good news. Here, I kind of already talked about companions. I got a little ahead of myself here. But you know, these are just kind of examples of the companion devices that you could have. They can be in any form factor. There are two modes for companion devices. One is where the device is a second factor. So in that scenario, you're still enrolled your PC. My credentials are on the PC itself. And then I just have another factor external that is required to unlock the PC. This other scenario is where the credential and the factors to get access to credential are all on the external device. So the government scenario we're talking about with FIPS 140-2, that's this scenario on your right. So credentials and factors there. So let's move to another topic. It's still related to identity, but let's talk about the biggest headache that everybody has. Some of you probably remember Heartbleed, but there was an interesting article that was talking about pass the hash as the is your biggest headache, and it's no doubt that it's true. Pass the hash, we'll talk about what it is, but pass the hash, in our estimation, is used in probably 100% of breaches. And you'll understand why here in a minute. But if we take this trick away from the adversaries, we can really disrupt them, right? Because they need it. They need it big time. Years ago, it was all hypothetical. You go to Black Hat, people were talking about pass the hash, but it required a ton of expertise. It's fully weaponized. It's in toolkits. Your mother, your grandmother can do pass the hash with a little bit of your help, I'm sure, because it's just easy because of the tooling that's out there. So we have to fix this problem. But let's talk a little more detail for those who are not familiar with it. Let's talk about what pass the hash is. So pass the hash is a situation where the attacker compromises an endpoint, and they steal your identity, and then they find a way to get some more. And so let's talk about how that happens. So what happens first is they breach the endpoint, they get admin control, and then they run a tool, one of these weaponized toolkits, called Mimikatz. Mimikatz is a tool that has the ability to dump the secrets out of the LSA service, which is our authentication broker. So all the authentication, all the secrets going through our authentication broker are in the LSAS service. So what does this mean? This means I can dump your username, I can dump in it your password, and I'm talking about Windows 7 and even 8, and I can also dump this thing that we call an NTLM hash. So what is an NTLM hash? Well, there's really two parts of your credential. There's a credential that you use to gain access to your network, and then there's this thing we call the derived credential that Active Directory gives back to you after you've authenticated. This token is used for single sign-on. So after you auth with your smart card or your password, you get this piece of data back. We call it an NTLM hash or a Kerberos ticket. Maybe you get both in your environment. And then after that, every device you connect to is not going to ask you to authenticate again as long as you have physical possession of this hash or this ticket, the curb ticket. So if I'm an attacker, if I can steal these tokens, I can impersonate you on the network without having your smart card or without knowing your name, without having your password. And so the attackers use Mimikatz to get these secrets. When they run this tool, anybody who's ever logged on the PC, all their secrets come out. So if Helpdesk logged in your PC yesterday, guess what? Attacker has your creds, also has Helpdesk creds. From there, they'll start hitting other machines all over the network. And they can say, okay, do you have access to this machine? They eventually are going to find one that you also have access to. If you're an admin on that machine, they're going to log into it. Then they're going to dump any secrets that are on that machine as well. And so what happens is it goes to like zombie apocalypse mode, right, where you get one hash, then you get two, and then four, and 16. It just goes on and on. And then you're going to find your way to the CA, right, or to the data center at least. So every attack uses this. Why? Because without this, I'm kind of stuck on one PC. And my goal as an attacker is to go from one PC into your data center. And so this is how they do it every single time. So the way you break this attack fundamentally is you move authentication out of the system. It's no longer running on Windows when you run Credential Guard, the feature that solves this problem. Credential Guard moves the LSA service into the isolation environment. All of your authentication happens there. All of your secrets are managed there. So this breaks past the hash. Mimikatz can run. And you'll see that they added some air handling to that. And you'll see it doesn't display anything useful anymore because they can't get anything. Actually, what it does display is it displays an encrypted version of your NTLM hash because that's the only thing that comes out of the other side. So this fundamentally breaks past the hash. Now, is it possible that I could still do past the hash? Yeah, in theory, because there is some surface area for attack. And this is applicable to anything in virtualization-based security. I should have actually talked about this earlier. Let's imagine you compromise the kernel on the left-hand side. You own the PC, obviously, but you don't own the right-hand side. If you found a vulnerability in the hypervisor, then you could move laterally. So that's the one attack vector. The good news, hypervisor is about that big, right, compared to the surface area of attack that it was beforehand. So we can't promise that the isolation environment will never be hacked, but what we can say is by sheer volume of surface area, it's going to happen a lot less, and you will never experience it. So that's CredGuard. CredGuard, actually, incidentally, I meet a lot with Department of Defense to educate them on what's coming and get their feedback and help build better features and let them know about what we're doing. And when we first exposed Credential Guard to them a couple of years ago, I guess it's almost 3 years ago now, they said, if you deliver that feature, if you give me CredGuard, which is their biggest nightmare, just like yours, we will move to Windows 10 and all the other features, that's all gravy. Just give us CredGuard. If it works like you say, that's all we needed to convince us that Windows 10 is important for us. And of course, as many of you know, the whole Department of Defense is committed to moving 4 million PCs to Credential Guard by January of 2017. They're not going to get that far, I don't think, based on the intel we have. But that's the ambition. That's how important they felt CredGuard was a feature. So they set a goal that they probably can't keep, but I guarantee they're going to have a huge portion of DoD will be moved over because of this. So anyway, so there's our identity solutions. One last thing that's worth mentioning, I should have mentioned this about Windows Hello. Windows Hello works with Azure Active Directory. It works with Active Directory environments where you're using Azure Active Directory with Connect. So if you have a hybrid environment, as we call that, then you can use Windows Hello in your environment. If your organization does not use Azure Active Directory, go use it. Go start POCing that. Put yourself in hybrid mode. If you can't, because you're a government or whatever and you can't be connected to the cloud, we will be delivering Active Directory on-prem mode next year in H1. And that will require an update to Windows. It'll require something that we ship next year in H1, and it will probably require an update to Server 2016. We'll see what's required. Maybe it's needed, maybe it's not. It'll at least require an update to the client. So let's talk about information protection. And I'm going to kind of move through some of this pretty quickly, just because I think I'm talking a little long. So let me just get to the meat here. So we have BitLocker. BitLocker is a technology that many people had looked at with Windows 7 but chose not to use because it was not manageable when we shipped Windows 7. And it took MBAM, Microsoft BitLocker Administration and Monitoring, to really make it enterprise ready. I was actually the program manager on the MBAM team for BitLocker, and I designed a lot of the MBAM features with the rest of the team. But that once we released that management functionality, we saw the hockey stick thing happen. We saw all of a sudden everybody started running to BitLocker because it was really the lack of management. It wasn't a lack of security. No matter what you read, if you type BitLocker hack, it's going to lead you to a YouTube video. If you want to have a conversation with me about that video and why we have all sorts of reasons or things in BitLocker that prevent that actually from happening in the real world, I'm happy to talk to you. In fact, what I can say is this. There are no known hacks to BitLocker that are in the wild right now. What are the tools? Passware, Elcomsoft, frozen memory stuff. All that stuff is garbage, right? They don't work unless you completely misconfigure BitLocker, and then you could be susceptible to those tools. So BitLocker has the security you need, BitLocker has the management you need, and when you move to Windows 10, you should really take a second look at it if you're using any third party. Using BitLocker gives you the best performance, the best upgrade story, right? A lot of our customers right now were blocked in moving from Windows 10 because McAfee encryption wasn't compatible with Windows 10. Please get off of the third-party encryption and go to BitLocker. It will meet your requirements. I would love to meet with anybody who wants to challenge the security elements of it, because we love you to use BitLocker. And you already own it. It's free, right? Why pay more money for this thing that's already there? So let's talk about something new, though. And so when it comes to data security, we need to protect data at rest. So when you lose your PC in the taxi cab, that you're well defended, right? We don't want somebody to pull the disk and get access to your data. But there are other ways that people lose data, and this is an interesting story, right? People are leaking data from Dropbox and all these other things. So I won't belabor the news clip here. But what I want to show you here is a little funny video, it'll take about 90 seconds, I think you'll enjoy it. It's kind of funny.
Most data leaks, well, not really intentional. I manage IT for Relic Cloud's marketing org, which is 450 seats. Like any place around, people just can make mistakes. They try to upload confidential documents onto personal cloud storage.
We're on mute, right?
Yeah, I think so.
What I would like to say is that is the stupidest idea I have ever heard.
Hello?
And copy and paste business information that's really confidential onto the non-corporate sites. We needed a solution that could tell the difference between the personal documents and those really critical business documents that need to be protected. Because a lot of people around here, they don't think. Microsoft's Enterprise Data Protection. I do sleep a little better, but just a little.
All right, I love that video, it's so funny. We cut this about a year ago, so maybe some of you have seen it before, but I just thought it's so funny. I love the analogy to data separation with the girl's hair, and it's taking her personal hair and chopping it up, obviously. But at any rate, great video. Hopefully not everybody's seen that one before, but let's talk about the solution. Now, the solution said Enterprise Data Protection. That was the code name, and again, we cut this video almost a year ago, but many people haven't seen it. We've now officially rebranded the feature is Windows Information Protection. So that's the feature. So if you're familiar with EDP, it's now called WIP, W-I-P, or Windows Information Protection. And the problem we're trying to solve is about accidental data loss, right? Turns out that most of the data that we lose in an organization is not through massive exfil by bad actors, it's by us accidentally leaking data. And so when the era of BYOD emerged so quickly, industry rushed to go solve this problem because we needed to have our personal phone with business data on it. And so industry built these solutions for mobile, and they built these container solutions that ran on top of the platform. And in building these containers, they created isolation between the platform and the business side. But the problem is it came with some big consequences, right? First of all, it's using a container, which is good from a security perspective, but also means that I have to switch kind of modes, or maybe I can't use Outlook anymore. I need to use this third-party email client that's very limited compared to what I use for my personal life or even my work life on my desktop. So there's all sorts of usability challenges that get introduced anytime you bring a container. In fact, my view is containers are not useful for data protection. They get in the way of the usability. Containers are wonderful for isolating components like we talked about earlier. So that's the perfect fit is for isolation of software components, not isolation of data. Somebody might want to challenge me on that, but that's my, I think it's even our view as a company. But what we can do with our solution, which we'll talk about here next, is we're able to, rather than using a container, we can provide you containment, because that's what you want. You want to prevent the data from leaking, right? Some people use a container. What we've done is we've baked the functionality of containment into the platform itself and just made that a native feature, which we call Windows Information Protection. So it doesn't matter where your data exists on the system. It can be in any folder, right? Windows is going to be able to identify business data and personal data, be able to apply rules to it, and prevent that data from being misused. So we have basically corporate and personal data separation without special places. It can all be commingled, but Windows knows what's yours and what's your business. So, of course, this data protection also continues when it moves to a USB drive. So if you move some business data to a USB drive, that protection travels with it, meaning you don't have to think about it as it moves to those devices. The beauty, of course, is it also gives you a common experience, right? So in an unfettered experience. So the experience on Windows Phone, if you're a Windows Phone user, and the experience you have on the desktop will be exactly the same. And in fact, the experience pretty much is non-existent, to be quite frank, because it's baked into the platform. Your user shouldn't have to think about this data protection except when they accidentally attempt to leak it. And that's where WIP really the only case where WIP will ever show its face, which is when you, let's imagine you've got a business document, you copy some text and you try to paste it to Twitter or you try to paste it into a personal document. Windows will do one of two things. It will either warn the user, depending on the policy that you set, it'll warn the user and say, hey, we're about to log this and we're going to let you continue with this operation, but be aware, this just got audited. So if you're doing the wrong thing, you could potentially be held accountable. We don't threaten them in the UI, but we'd make sure that they're clear about what's going on. Or you can just block it, right? So you can choose which policy to use, and you can choose which policy to apply to different users. You may want to trust certain people in your organization and allow them to leak data with the warning, or you may want to block it completely depending on their job function. So that's, in a nutshell, what Windows Information Protection is all about. It's about data separation, about applying rules on how data can leak into the personal world or the public world. Another thing that Windows Information Protection has is it also has the ability to define which applications have access to your data. So we can also, you can do the copy-paste rule, but we can also say, hey, these are the only apps that actually can access business data. And that kind of gives it a little bit of the flavor of what we were doing with, or what others were doing with containers, right? So now we can say, hey, only Office can use our business documents. It can't be a piece of malware that got installed on the machine, as an example, or some other Office document editor that we don't want our users using. So in fact, if you had malware that tried to exfil this data from your PC, they could exfil the data, but it would be encrypted, and the keys wouldn't exist. So you wouldn't have to worry about data that had been stolen because it's going to get sent encrypted. So we're going to skip the demo just in the interest of time. And one thing that Windows Information Protection probably sounds like, it sounds like rights management. I thought Office had this functionality. You're right. What we've done is we're building this as a base platform feature. So in a way, we're kind of moving some of the RMS functionality into the platform itself so everybody gets this benefit. And then we continue to work with rights management services, so when you want to egress content, so when it's going to get sent through email, they can apply another layer of protection that allows the user to send the data through email in a protected way, and then the keys can be exchanged using Azure so that recipient can receive the email. And then if they forward it, of course, to someone else, of course, they wouldn't have access to those keys. So there is a better together story with WIP and RMS. They work together, and it's the RMS feature is about egressing the data outside of your organization and continuing the protection there. So let's talk about our last area. If my clicker will work. There we go. Okay. All right, as we talked about, you're 1-0 day away from being owned on a PC. And so what we've found is through some of the campaigns we've done on our own Microsoft employees and based also on what we have assembled using our intelligent security graph and et cetera, is we know that when most people will click on these malicious links when they manage to make it through the email system. In fact, of 100 people, in our estimation, 23 people are going to click on a malicious link. And if there's a 0-day or unpatched mullein on the system, they're going to get owned, right? It's actually 11 at the end. Oh, 23 will open, 11 people will open an attachment if it was included. And so at any rate, it's pretty bad numbers. And so you have to assume, even with all these great defenses we've already talked about, device guard, cred guard, virtualization-based security, the new secure browser, right? You're going to see your protection level for the first time ever go up the hockey stick, and it's going to be near, you know, at the top, right? It's not going to be incremental. But there are going to be there's going to be attacks in the future, right? These adversaries are not going to pack their bags in frustration and stop hacking. They're going to be far more less successful than they've ever been, and they're going to be really angry about it. But they're going to continue to come after you and our products. And so what we need is we need the ultimate backstop. We need something in the post-breach world to detect when all these other defenses have failed. And again, it'll be far less than you've ever experienced, but it's going to happen eventually. And so Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection is not a signature-based antivirus solution. This is about detecting advanced, highly targeted attacks where vulnerabilities and these types of exploits are being used, right? This is designed to detect the Syrian army or Strontium or Anonymous, these types of actors who are using very sophisticated means to breach into your organization. And so what is Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection? It is really a couple of pieces. It's a flight data recorder. We've built instrumentation in Windows that allows Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection to really detect everything that's going on the PC, every process that's running, everything that it touches, other processes that it talks to, files that it opens or creates or drops. Every bit of activity is being mapped out, and the relationships between those activities are all mapped. So we see this web of activity with all these processes and these things, and we see them connecting to the web. We have all this information. That information then will be sent up to your tenant in the cloud. And then our machine learning and our human hunters will have access to it. So, you know, 99% of the stuff is going to be detected by the machines, and we have human hunters who are also looking through for anomalies. So sometimes our machine learning will say, hey, that's an attack, I know that one, I know who did it. Sometimes it's like, hey, we see something odd, but we're not really sure if it's a good or bad thing. That's where it gets assigned to a hunter, as we call them, who's going to take a closer look and see if they can find out what's going on. And they may find nothing. They're like, oh, that's this anomaly. Let's go fix our machine learning so it doesn't see this as anomalous behavior. Or they may add what we call a new indicator of compromise into the system so that next time we see something like it, we know, okay, we know what that is. So that's the cloud piece and the computing piece. And then, of course, the last piece of it, of course, is the threat intelligence. You know, ATP is a product that's designed to compete with FireEye, right? Everybody knows that name out there. This is designed and we think has the capability to go toe-to-toe with a product like that. Microsoft has FireEye deployed internally, which is probably no great surprise. It's a very high-quality product. It's actually quite great. When we deployed Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection, 60% of the things that we discovered were detected by this and not by FireEye. So that should give you an idea of how good this thing is, right? In fact, I was just talking to Dustin Engels. Dustin Engels is the GM over in MSIT, and he's telling me, he's like, man, when our customers deploy ATP, that's going to be a bad day for them because they're going to find so many attacks that they did not know were happening, just like we did at Microsoft. When we deployed this, we didn't realize we were breaching in a number of cases. So there's some things going on in our network that even we didn't know, even with all the other best stuff in the industry. So we think even with the V1, we've got a really compelling product. We think we compete well. And that's not to say that you don't need FireEye anymore. I'm not making that claim. I'm not saying that there's 100% parity in these products. There isn't. But I can tell you that we can discover a lot of things that at this point they're not. So something you might add to the toolbox. So let me show you just a quick demo, and then we'll wrap up here. Let's see here. All right. So here's the ATP. Where's my mouse? Okay, here we go. So, you know, this is exactly what you expect. Looks similar to other Microsoft consoles you probably have. It's an alert console, obviously. You want to focus on those. Let's go ahead and dive in. And what you see here is we see a very specific attack. And this is one of the things that makes ATP so interesting is we know exactly what happened in a lot of cases, right? A lot of products raise a bunch of alerts, and you've got to go figure out what it is, right? We know in this case, this is that actual backdoor, and we know that the adversarial group, NarrowBlaze, did it. So that's something that we really take a lot of pride in, is like we're giving you real alerts, not wild goose chases like a lot of other products have, and we're giving you very, very specific knowledge about what's happening and who's done it. Because when we're talking about advanced threats, if you don't know who the adversary is, you're not going to know how to deal with their tactics, right? So this is central to a product. So if we drill in a little deeper, you'll see that, you know, we have more information about what this is. We have, you know, mitigation steps, etc. Let me scroll down here. You'll see we have this thing called the instant graph. We only have one machine here. Oftentimes you'd see a web of connections between other machines that are being part of the attack by NeuroBlaze. In this demo, we didn't have that connection, sadly. If we drill down onto Abby's laptop here, you'll see what we call the timeline. So we see every single thing that's happening on this PC in order, and you'll see that once we had seen enough of these events, which individually didn't mean a whole lot of anything, once we saw enough of them, the machine learning said, hey, I see this sequence of events. That looks a lot like this type of attack, and then it drills down a little deeper, and we say, hey, that's actually NeuroBlaze. That's kind of how the system works. I think if we drill in here, you'll see, a little bit more data. In the console. Let's see here. This is operating on live data, so every time I look at the console, it's always a little bit different. But something I think it's interesting here is you can see, I mentioned that we have that web of connections between all activity on the system. As you can see here, as you drill down, we're able to see exactly what the attacker did. If you look at the, there it says cmd.forward/c executed this executable, which was downloaded, which then unpacked some binaries, and then you had a key logger, it looks like, and then they ran something as service. So what they're trying to do here is they're trying to install a service and then hide themselves from other products that might attempt to detect it. So that's just a real quick overview of what ATP looks like. And then let's go ahead and go back to the presentation. And then I think we are a wrap here for the end. So this is just a slide just talking about the Department of Defense. I kind of unpacked that earlier. And so that's Windows 10 security. I went a little bit long. I didn't leave much time for questions. But this is the last session of the day, so I'll stay here as long as you want to ask questions. So I hope you found the information useful. Thank you very much for attending.